Good evening. This is Outbeat Radio host Greg Moralia. During this public health emergency, your Outbeat Radio team is working hard to bring you current news, events, and content while social distancing and working from home. And although the sound quality may not be as great as we would like, our team is committed to producing a weekly show for you to learn from and enjoy. So thanks for being here tonight. And now, here's Living Proof.
Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m. This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. We have Pam Walton and Ruth Carranza here with us. Pam was a high school English teacher for 20 years before she went back to Stanford in 1985 and got a master's in documentary film production. She's been making documentaries about LGBTQ lives ever since. And now she's retired and living with Ruth at Fountain Grove Lodge in Santa Rosa. Ruth was working at the Center for Materials Research at Stanford in 1985 when she joined the master's in film program. And since then, she has produced a 9-part series on semiconductor manufacturing, MEMS, and nanotechnology. Wow, she sounds like a huge scientist to me. Yeah. She's also retired and lives with Pam at Fountain Grove Lodge in Santa Rosa, California.
Before we get to Pam and Ruth's story and learning even more about them, we have news and events from our Outbeat member, our friend, our engineer, Greg Moralia. I'd love to change the world,
but I don't know what to do. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of May 3rd, 2020. According to the LGBTQ news organization Shams, a same-sex marriage was reportedly legally accepted as valid in the African country of Tunisia, a first for a Muslim-majority nation. A Tunisian man and a French man who married in France were able to get their marriage recognized in the North African country and mentioned on the Tunisian man's birth certificate. Homosexuality is illegal in the country and punishable with up to 3 years in prison. Discrimination against LGBTQ people remains perfectly legal there, and of course, the country does not grant same-sex couples marriage licenses. But Shams wrote on April 24th in a Facebook post that this is a new achievement for gay Tunisians, saying that it's the first same-sex marriage to be legally recognized in the history of Tunisia and the Arab world. Many of the comments on Facebook, however, were negative, calling the post a lie, a sign of moral collapse, and that it should not even be discussed during Ramadan. And here in the Bay Area, last Tuesday, San Francisco airport officials opened the newly remodeled section of Terminal 1 that includes the new permanent installation honoring the late gay supervisor Harvey Milk. Harvey Milk Terminal 1's new intimate space features 43 images from various stages of Milk's life, including his childhood in New York and his days as a pioneering politician in San Francisco during the 1970s. The exhibit is titled Harvey Milk, Messenger of Hope, and utilizes photos submitted by the public and from archives of the GLBT Historical Society and the James C. Hormel LGBTQI Center at the San Francisco Public Library. The space will be accessible to anyone traveling through the pre-security area of Milk Terminal, the first of three domestic terminals at SFO. Past the security zone remains a gigantic 400-foot wall running the length of the terminal, featuring nearly 100 images related to Milk's life. While SFO has remained operational despite seeing a drastic decline in airline passengers due to the global pandemic, it pushed off opening the new terminal for 6 weeks. Because projects at the airport were deemed essential, construction crews have continued to work on the phased $2.4 billion remodel of Harvey Milk Terminal 1. On Tuesday, JetBlue was the first airline to move into its new ticket counter and baggage claim area in the terminal. Southwest did the claim on Thursday. Tim O'Brien, assistant director and curator of the exhibition at SFO, said, quote, "It should be a wonderful amenity for everyone flying through here." And also in San Francisco, San Francisco's leather and kink celebrations, the Folsom Street Fair and Up Your Alley have been canceled this year and will be replaced with virtual events. Organizers confessed they considered simply shutting down the long-running street festivals, but felt obligated to provide an online alternative. The virtual events will still happen on the previously scheduled dates. Up Your Alley weekend starts on July 26th, and the Folsom Street Fair begins on September 27th. Organizers said that there will definitely be music and productions from regular DJs and entertainers, as well as the usual adult themes. Organizers say they will announce more details once they, quote, work out the kinks. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana and Sheridan. And in studio, we have Pam Walton and Ruth Carranza. Thank you both so much for joining us tonight.
We're happy to be here.
And who just said that? Very
Pam,
happy.
Pam, I did. Pam.
Okay. And Ruth, let us hear your voice.
Oh, I'm here too.
All right, because you both sound a little similar. And because we can't see you, because we are all in shelter in place, we are doing a Zoom audio only interview. So we can't see each other. So we just wanted to get used to your voices. Okay. And speaking of shelter in place, we wanted to talk to you a little bit about shelter in place because you both are at Fountain Grove Lodge. Uh-huh. And it's LGBT senior living. And we just wanted to know, how are things going there with the shelter in place when y'all, I don't know how many people that live there. Why don't you give us an overview and how that is going for you guys?
Let's see. Fountain Grove Lodge is a retirement community for about 90 residents. And the focus is LGBTQ, although there are about 50% people here who call themselves allies, and they're the straight people. And we all get along very well, I think. We're sheltering in place along with all the other people in Santa Rosa. And, you know, I feel blessed to be here because we're taken really good care of. The medical staff takes our temperature once or twice a day. The kitchen brings our food to our apartments. We are all following level 2 protocols, wear masks when we leave our apartments. And, you know, it's isolating and tiresome, but it's, you know, the alternative would be terrible if we didn't have everything in place to take care of ourselves.
When you say level 2 protocol, can you explain what that means?
Yeah, it means that we're asked, encouraged not to leave the building unless we're going to take a walk, maybe with the dogs or just to get some fresh air. When we leave our apartments, we're required to wear a mask. The place is our home, but our apartments are really our home. So when we enter the community areas, we wear a mask.
Level 3 would be if it turns out that one of the staff or a resident is having problems, then they go into a different level. There's 4 levels, and we're on 2 right now. I mean, nobody is found to have symptoms, so we're at 2. But if it did happen, then we'd have to go up to a different level.
Anyone who has symptoms would be put in isolation with medical staff. And then the rest of the residents would stay in their apartments.
Well, that's great that you all feel very well taken care of. I'm wondering about people who live alone. I think it's easier for like couples.
Yes.
Like you both and Diana and me, because we have each other to keep us company. I'm wondering, I know there are people that live alone at Fountain Grove Lodge.
Well, the good thing is that you can get out and walk around, and they encourage that. We have dogs, so we have to go out, walk the dogs. But, you know, people get out and walk around.
And today they tried a little groupie thing. We had a barbecue lunch around the pool, and we had to meet in the living room and then be escorted to the pool in groups of 10. And out at the pool, we had to stay 6 feet apart.
and only 10 people in the pool area.
We could eat by our, you know, at proper distances and mostly keep our masks on. So it was a little weird, but, you know, they're trying to keep us from being too lonely.
So what would you say the fear level would be around the lodge?
I haven't sensed there's any real fear or over anxiety going on. We see people in the hall and wave, "How are you doing?" Almost everybody says, "A little bored, but otherwise fine."
We also have exercises. We have yoga, functional fitness, and we do Tai Chi through our instructor who's up on the screen.
It's great talking to you guys about Fountain Grove Lodge. It's nice to have some kind of insight into a retirement community. So let's get into your personal stories. I understand that you both got married in 2008 and you've been together 33 years. Is that true?
That's right.
That's a long time.
That's a long time.
Why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
This is Pam. I'll start. I was a high school English teacher and I was in the closet and I was getting really tired of being in the closet. This was the early 1980s, and I had been interested in filmmaking for a while. I taught a little Super 8 filmmaking class in the high school. And so when I heard about Stanford's documentary film program, I applied and decided it was time to leave teaching when I got accepted. And it was just fabulous to be out finally after all those years. At that point, I was 40, and I decided to make up for all the lost time by making documentary films about gay and lesbian issues. So that's what I've been doing. And while I was in that program, I looked up one day, and there was this gorgeous woman standing in the hall holding all of her film reels. And I thought, wow, who is this? And I soon got to know it was Ruth Carranza. And that was the beginning of our relationship.
That's nice.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Ruth.
Well, I was working at the Center for Materials Research, growing crystals. And I decided that instead of writing little pictures every 4 or 5 hours when I had to check my experiments, I decided that, you know, it really would be much more efficient if we did time-lapse. And that's what drew me to film. Was that I wanted to learn, you know, how to, we got a camera, but I wanted to learn how to use it. And so I thought, well, I'm going to take a film class. And so that's what drew me to class, to the film program. I was able to audit a summer program at Stanford. And it was just, you know, I loved it. I loved the hard work and the creativity that you put into it. And it was just something that I could work on all day long and night if I had to. And I knew that I loved film. And at the same time, I loved my science. So I knew I would be a science filmmaker. That was my goal.
What took you to Stanford versus another institution?
Well, because I was working at Stanford. I was a research technician. So I was already working there. And that's why I got to audit that summer without having to pay an arm and a leg. Then the instructor encouraged me to apply for the master's program. And I knew I wanted to go to my master's in something, but I wasn't sure what. And when I did this program, I knew that this would work out. So I was afraid of the expense of going to Stanford. In fact, I felt like there was no way I could do that. And the instructor encouraged me to just apply and get accepted. And if you get accepted, then you deal with that. So that's what I did. And it was, you know, it worked out.
When did you gaze upon Pam?
Well, that first time I heard rumors about this person that had come in and was doing a gay film. So I made sure I attended because I was ahead of Pam. I was finishing my master's film and she was just starting. And so I heard when they were showing the students' films, I wanted to be sure I showed up and saw it. And it blew me away because it all started with this music. They went dun, 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 dun. And then it came out lesbians. And I was like, wow. I got to check her out. So
were you out
Yeah, I was asking. Were you out, Ruth?
I was, yes. Ooh. I've been out since I was, what, 1920?
1920.
I was out since I was like 20 years old.
I'm curious about the next step. What happened? How did you, after you saw that beautiful film and the music?
Yeah. You know? But the thing was that every time I stepped forward, she was already involved. So she was unavailable.
What do you mean every time? Every time you step forward.
Oh, you know, we were good friends for about a year before we got involved. This is Pam again. And I had been having a relationship with a woman who lived in New York. So it was doomed to failure. And Ruth and I hung out and we started doing things together. And we went to a few documentary festivals. And, you know, one night I just said, well, Ruth, what's going on between us? And she collapsed into my arms. And that was the beginning of it. And we, you know, we sort of dated for a while. I tried to tell her that I was just recovering from this long-term relationship and I should just take it slowly. And she did not want to take it slowly. And so within about a year, we had found a great place to rent and we started living together.
So how long was your program? A couple years or how long were you in school?
Well, we did, the first year was mostly classwork and student projects. And then after that, we had up to 3 years to finish our thesis film.
And Ruth, you mentioned that you were ahead of Pam in your program.
Right. Uh-huh.
So you graduated before she did then, right?
Yes. In fact, it was on that day that I showed my film. It was my master's thesis. So I showed it at Stanford and I needed someone I was looking for another student to help because we had food and stuff out there. And she had agreed to work on my project. Anyway, when we showed the film and it was great and she came back to say goodbye, she kissed me. I couldn't believe it. You know, we weren't there at that point.
Don't tell too much.
And that's when, but you know what? My stomach made a turn when she did that. You know, it flipped.
Nauseous.
And it just totally flipped. And I said, wow. Because I thought she was going to be one of those little kisses on the cheek. And she kissed me on the mouth. And I thought, oh my God. And my stomach just went upside down. So I knew this was something. Yeah, your body reacts, you know. You got to listen to it.
Wow, that's so beautiful. It's a beautiful story. Pam, what made you give her a big kiss on the mouth?
Well, as I told you, we had been seeing each other as friends. But there was some energy crackling between us. So I just took a step and gave her a kiss.
Were you nervous?
Well, I ran home. I ran home and told my friend Keenan, oh my God, I kissed Ruth. And Keenan raised her eyebrows, and so that was it. Getting married was interesting. For years, I had been asking Ruth to have some kind of commitment ceremony with me, and she was adamant. She did not want to go through that unless it was a legal ceremony. So finally, when we were able to do it in 2008, I got kind of cold feet and I didn't want to go to the San Jose courthouse and stand in front of some old judge and get married. It felt too oppressive the way marriage can be, but she really wanted to do it. So we went down there and I was getting more and more nervous by the minute. And we got in front of the judge and got all these papers and everything done. You know, we were lucky to have this man marry us who said that he was a little left of Karl Marx in his politics. And so he was very open to what we were doing. And as it turned out, when we got to the part where he said, by the state of California, I now pronounce you married, I was so moved, I just couldn't stop crying. So surprised at how much it meant to me to be married. So that was an experience.
Wow, that's beautiful. And I noticed there was no gender or no kind of label, wife or, you know, anything like that, but married.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was great.
That was touching right there just to hear that. Wow.
Yeah. And the part about by this, the power invested me in the state of California.
Yeah.
I had no idea how much that would mean to me to have that proclamation.
And so Ruth's insistence on doing it legally really paid off.
Yep.
So Ruth, share about your experience and why the desire for that was so important for you and your experience with hearing those words.
Being married, you know, it says a lot. And it says a lot to your family. You know, family can accept gay or whatever, you know, maybe, but they don't understand it. Domestic partners, they don't know what domestic partnership is. They could care less. And they don't understand it and don't care. To them, Pam is just someone I was living with. But yet, if when you're married, it means something. It becomes your sister-in-law. You know, there's commitment there, family commitment. So for me, I wanted it legal because it just, it's easier. Family understands that. Yeah, it was important to me. And of course, I wanted, you know, I so much wanted legal marriage for gays, you know, in California or wherever.
Thank you so much. I feel like this is a really good time to break for our music break. And I'd like, Ruth, I'd like you to introduce the song that you brought tonight and then we'll play it.
Okay, it's with Etta James. And it says, at last, our love is here to stay.
And the reason it's so important is that, you know, we didn't do anything fancy about getting married. We went to the San Jose courthouse. I took a friend to be my witness, and Ruth took her brother, Jesse. And Jesse was so wonderful. He brought flowers. He took pictures. And when we were leaving, he pulled out this little audio card and opened it up, and it was Etta James singing "At Last."
Oh.
Last.
And Etta, you know, I love Etta James, and that had always been a good song from her. And he didn't know this, and yet his card on our wedding had this song, and it's just forever will be our song.
In heaven,
And hello, if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana and Sheridan. And again, in studio, we have Pam Walton and Ruth Carranza. They just played their song, which was Etta James singing At Last. And before our music break, told us about why that music is so important to them. And it was a beautiful story. So welcome back, both of you. Let's go with your younger years. How was it in your families? How old were you when you came out? And those types of things. Pam, could you start?
Sure. I was born in 1944 and grew up in the 50s and the 60s. So it wasn't a great time to be realizing that you're a lesbian. So I was having feelings at a really young age and just learned how to keep it all to myself. The other part of it that was difficult was that my father was deeply into right-wing politics. And so neither he nor my mother was very open to knowing that they had a lesbian daughter. I mean, the word lesbian wasn't even in existence in our family. And I think by the time I got to high school, I had pretty much buried myself emotionally. I was not at all interested in boys. I had crushes on teachers and girlfriends, and I just absolutely devoted myself to getting good grades. I was the best student I could be. So I got straight A's in high school, and I realize now that I was planning my exit from that family. Everybody's got probably a dysfunctional story to tell about their families, but mine, I think, was especially oppressive. So I went off to college, and it wasn't much better in college in 1964. I remember the dean of women at Whitman College getting all the freshmen together and telling us that we should beware the dangers of lesbianism. And, you know, everybody in the room nodded their heads, and I thought, oh my God, it was a bad time. I thought about suicide, actually, because I thought, how am I ever going to live in this world with these strong feelings about women? And of course, I thought I was the only one at Whitman College who felt this way. And, you know, an experience that I think is common to a lot of women my age, thinking when they were teenagers that they were the only person in the world who was like them. So I went off to another college, Riverside University of California, but I didn't finally come out until I was 25, when I met somebody who really loved me and who I really loved and I saw as a doorway to getting out of all the closeted life I had been living. So that was the early 70s. And I wasn't really out then. Nobody that I knew then was really out. So by the time I got to my 40s in 1985, I was ready to get out.
So you came out to yourself pretty much when you were 20. I mean, you knew you were gay, but you just stayed in the closet until you were 25. Is that right? And then you were teaching, so you really couldn't come out either. So when you finally went to your master's program in 1985, that's when you could come out publicly?
Yeah. I was out to myself in college, and I finally came out to friends that I thought I was a lesbian. And I had a very unpleasant experience with a therapist at the college. I went to her and talked to her about my feelings. And then between sessions, I decided I was going to find out what it meant to be with a man. So I picked out a guy and I decided I was going to have sex with him. And it was awful. It was awful for him and it was awful for me. And he was probably gay too. Next time I went back to the therapist, told her about this experience, she told me she thought I was cured. And that was the end of the therapy. And so that's where therapy was. That's where the counseling department at UC Riverside was in 1964. You know, so it was just very painful. And from there, I moved into a relationship with a woman while I was at Stanford that was abusive emotionally and physically. And I understand how women go through those abusive relationships. I couldn't see a way out of it. My self-esteem was in the pits. My self-esteem was so low, I couldn't see a way out of the relationship until I met Keenan, this woman who really grabbed hold of me and pulled me through that whole awful experience.
Thank goodness for Keenan. Yeah.
Hey.
She really saved your life, it sounds like.
Yes.
But I want to say that Keenan is here with us at Fountain Grove.
You're kidding.
Oh, yes.
So how did that happen?
Well, she's been part of Pam's life ever since and part of my life also. And we convinced her to join us, to come to Fountain Grove and be with us because she, you know, she's older than us. She's 86. And we wanted her here so that we could continue to care for her as she moves forward. It's a long, wonderful relationship.
That is a beautiful story that Keenan is here and you're all together and your family together. I'm curious about Keenan. How did you meet her?
She was a teacher at Woodside High School. And for a while, we shared a classroom. And I was 25. I was involved in this awful relationship. And I thought, you know how you have gaydar? Keenan and I kind of resonated with each other. And I knew that this was a person I wanted to be close to. And, you know, it just developed from there.
So if you were in the closet while you were teaching, I'm assuming Keenan was in the closet also. How did you all come to know about each other? What was that like?
There was a kind of like a subtext subgroup of people at Woodside High School who were either gay or who were totally accepting of gay people. So we had friends, we had our group, we had our community at the high school. Of course, it was all undercover. It was that era of Anita Bryant and Briggs. People were trying to take our jobs away from us for being gay. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't talk about it openly. You know, that was just a nightmare. It was horrible.
I can't imagine. I mean, I also taught school for 18 years and I was not out in the beginning, but I was sure was out by the end of my career. I'd say I was out the last 10 years of my career. So to not be able to talk about your life when all your other colleagues can, that is just really miserable.
And of course, the students all figure it out when you're 35 and not married and don't talk about boyfriends.
Yeah, well, they're smart. Yeah. Well, wow. Thank you so much, Pam, for sharing a bit of yourself with us.
Okay, Ruth, so we'd like to know about your life as a young person and coming out, and when did you know?
First of all, unlike Pam, I was terrible at high school. I didn't have good grades at all.
And why was that?
I wasn't living at home anymore. I was living on my own with my sister. For me, work meant money, and then I could live separate from not having to live at home if I worked. So work was the issue. You know, I didn't care about school because school would just took time. But the only reason I was going to school was because my father didn't think girls should need it to go to school. And he didn't want me to go to high school. There's 13 kids in my family. And he took all of us out of school right when you were 16. We were living in Texas. When you were 16, took you out of school. But when we came to California, he didn't have that kind of control because my sister and brother made the family move to California. So he didn't have that kind of control. So it was my choice. You know, there was two rules that they gave imposed on my dad, and that was he couldn't hit anybody and he couldn't take us out of school. That had to be our choice.
Why did your sister have that kind of power over your dad?
Well, she had that power when she moved us from Texas to California. So and that was a rule because he wasn't going to join us when we moved to California. And when he did, they made that the rule that if he joined the family, then he couldn't hit anybody and he couldn't take us out of school. When I started high school, he approached and said, I don't think you need to go to school. And I just knew I had to go to school because I had envisioned the diploma that I would get would be that hard parched paper. And I envisioned I was going to hand it back to him when I finished high school so that he could wipe his with it. Because he said he could wipe his with my diploma. And I thought, ha! That's a good idea.
Why would he want to take you out of school at 16? I missed that part.
They were fanatic religious. They'd come from Mexico. Most of my siblings are from Mexico. And he felt, you know, he didn't want us mixing with sinners. which is what the schools would have. So it was just crazy. I wasn't living at home. I mean, that, you know, pretty much right after junior high and that, I pretty much managed to get out and live on my own. But I really wanted the independence of supporting myself so that because I didn't want anybody telling me what to do. So School was not my priority. Pam was very good. And I was barely made it. Barely.
It's so interesting to me, Ruth, that you did not want to drop out. You wanted to go, you wanted your diploma, but you didn't do well in school because it wasn't your priority.
Right. Because I worked. I worked all weekend. I worked nights. My priority was work.
And your priority was, getting money so you could be on your own.
But I could be free.
Yeah.
Which was a dream.
Yeah, that is very clear. Your dad sounds very interesting person.
Strong personality.
And 12 siblings, huh?
Yep. And I'm number 12.
Wow. You are number 12?
I'm number 12. So I'm second to the youngest.
What are your relationships with your siblings like?
With my siblings, there was 13 of us, and there's older ones, you know, that you hardly knew. So there was mixtures that, you know, as you grew up, you got involved. And so there was like 3 or 4 that I was really close to, and others that were, you know, and so then the ones I'm close to are not especially religious. The others, there's another cloud that's very religious, and another one that we interact. You're especially close to certain siblings.
So I'm curious about Ruth. You know, we want to go back a little bit because you were in your story and it was powerful about your dad and you wanted to get your diploma. Did you get your diploma, and did you ever go to your dad and do your thing that you wanted to do?
No, I did get my diploma, but everybody around me made such a fuss about it, about graduating, you know, and getting the costume and the hat and the, you know, all that stuff that goes with high school. I started to think, wow, maybe there is something about this diploma that's important. And maybe I shouldn't give it to my dad. So then I thought, no, maybe I better save this thing, because somehow a lot of people make a big deal of it. I just put it away.
And now she has a master's from Stanford.
That's amazing. Wow, what a story. What a beginning. Ruth, when did you know you were gay?
When I graduated, I decided I wanted to move far away. But my brother convinced me that instead of going to Hawaii, which is what I was thinking, because friends had moved over there, was that maybe I should consider Mexico. Because if I ran out of money and needed help, I couldn't swim back from Hawaii. But if I went to Mexico, I could walk back. And I thought, well, okay, that makes sense too. I had a cousin that had invited me to come visit her. And, you know, I think she just totally understood me and gravitated towards me and knew what I was going through. So I ended up going to Acapulco, where she was, and ended up spending time there. And while I was there, she was sharing an apartment with a friend and who had a couple of daughters. And one of the daughters and I were especially close. And she made a pass at me, and I had to think about it. And, you know, and I really liked her, and she met all the criteria that I had for someone that I thought I would want to be involved with. Somebody you cared about, somebody that was a friend, somebody that you respected, you know, all those things were things that were there between, you know, with her, and that I cared about her. So when that came up, I hadn't thought of that as an option. I wasn't exposed to anything like that. So I thought, you know what? I need to try this. I need to see. I mean, the only issue is their sexuality. Is there compatibility sexually? She had approached me, and I was not knowing what to do about it. So I called her up, set it up, and I said, I want to come. And so for me, it was like, if it works, then absolutely. So it worked. It worked. And that was great. And we stayed, I mean, it was this long distant passionate relationship, because she's in Mexico. And then I came back to California. And then she finally came back to California with me. She was a med student. And by then I had gotten myself into college. And so I ended up at UCLA, and she ended up there with me while I was going at UCLA. I was going for a biological science degree. And she went on with her studies and she to pass the, what is it, the medical school
boards.
So she was working on that and she took the boards and she passed them. And we had a wonderfully stormy relationship, but good, for about 7 years. And then it just changed. We broke up, but we're still, you know, we're distant friends. I mean, we call each other on our birthdays and things like that.
That's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
Ruth, are you bilingual?
Yes. My first language was Spanish. I learned it by going to school.
By going to school, not from your parents?
No, we couldn't speak English in my home because the schools in Texas wouldn't let us speak Spanish. You would get spanked with a paddle if you spoke Spanish. So my dad was so furious about that he said, if you can't speak Spanish in school, you can't speak English at home. And he was very strict about that. So we spoke Spanish at home, and I'm glad at this point.
did your father understand English?
Yes.
That's interesting. I guess you had to learn both languages, but kind of in a oppressive way.
Right.
I want to ask you to share something that you enjoy as a couple together, like coming together for 33 years. What are some of the pastimes, some of the things that really brings you joy together?
Well, I think the fact that we were both filmmakers and with our own individual specialties.
Yeah. It's true. Both being filmmakers, we've had patience with each other's lives because it's hard to be a filmmaker. You don't know where the money's going to come from. And also, we're such different. We have such different subject matters. Yeah. My films are about gay and lesbian lives, and Ruth's films are about science. Now that we're in our 70s, one of the things we get a lot of pleasure out of is climbing into bed at night and doing crossword puzzles.
Together or
together?
Together.
Together.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Nice. Actually, I control it and then Pam answers them. She answers a lot of them because she's got more of the culture and all that than I do. But we, yeah. And it's a wonderful way to finally fall asleep.
Oh, how sweet.
Yeah. Of course, Pam does Scrabble. She does crossword puzzles all day. She does them on computers with different friends. And, you know, she's just and always doing them in the newspaper. That's the first thing she picks. It's a crossword puzzle. So she's, you know, she's got the hang of it.
She's brilliant. Yeah, she's the straight A student type.
Yeah.
Don't play against Pam. Hey, before you guys give us your advice, I have one other question for you, especially maybe for Pam with the LGBT films. Could you tell us the titles of some of your films and then maybe the listening audience would go check them out or something?
Sure. Let's see. Right now, all of my films are distributed through New Day Films, and the whole collection is on Canopy, which is a public library service. So people who have a public library card can get into their Canopy catalog and find almost all of my films. So that's nice.
If they don't know the name of your films, can they put your name in and have your films come up?
Yes, they can put my name in, Pam Walton. They can also do a subject matter search, gay and lesbian search, the documentaries. And let's see, the first one I made was for my master's thesis at Stanford. It was called Out in Suburbia, and it was released in 1986. When it was still a lot more difficult to be a lesbian than it is now. It was all about my friends in suburbia who were leading very ordinary lives, except horrors, they were lesbian. So that film was the first. And then I moved on to making a film about gay and lesbian youth because my own youth had been so tortured. I wanted to, make a film about that time of life when it's especially hard to know that you're gay and what do you do with it. And then I finally came to terms with my father and his right-wing politics and made a film called Family Values. Yeah, it was called Family Values and American Tragedy. And it was how my experience of living was and is that my family is my lesbian family and that my biological family was pretty much a disaster. So ironically, my father was a family values activist. So we wanted to make a film about that and expose some of that hypocrisy.
Did you say you have 9 films?
Yeah, 9 films. One is about the Lutheran Church and these gay members of the Lutheran Church trying to get ordained as pastors. Another one was Liberty, 3 stories about life and death about my own lesbian family. And then 2 small films. And now Ruth and I are involved in making a film about Fountain Grove Lodge.
Whoa, nice. Oh, can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
How is that going?
It's taking shape. We have, you know, something close to a rough cut. And we're using all this time in quarantine to edit and put it together. We have a lot of footage.
When do you think that might be ready for viewing?
If we ever get out of quarantine, I think we might be releasing it after the first of the year.
Oh, that's going to be something to look forward to. Wow, that's going to be really fantastic. So if people want to find your films, they go onto Canopy. They need a public library card, and then they can look under your name, Pam Walton, and look for your films.
Yes.
Fantastic. So we are at the end of our show, and we are sad to see you go. But before you go, we were wondering if you might have some words of wisdom for our listeners. Each one of you maybe take 30 seconds or so. You can call it words of advice or you can call it words of wisdom, but something to help somebody who's listening to your story right now. What would you say?
Let's see. This is Pam. You know, I think it's a much kinder, better time to be gay or lesbian than it was when I was growing up. But I also know that it's still hard. Just find a way to surround yourself with people who love you and support you if you're gay or lesbian. It's getting better all the time. Just imagine, Ruth and I can legally marry now, and that is something that I never thought would happen to me. I feel completely optimistic now about what's ahead for gay and lesbian people. I think Trump is a flash in the pan, and he'll be gone soon. And we'll continue the progress we've made with gay and lesbian rights. And it's a good time to be alive. Don't lose sight of that.
Thank you, Pam. Those are really, really important words.
Really important.
So Ruth.
Yes.
Let's hear what advice you have to offer.
I just want to say that I think that feeling of love is so special that nobody should take it for granted. And you have to be careful with it. You have to take care of it because it's so good.
Beautiful. Thank you, Ruth. Thank you so much, both of you. Yes. We want you to remember that, like Ruth and Pam, you too can be living proof that through sharing your craft, your passion, your creative expression, you can make our world a better world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we will be back next month. Until then,
good night.
Step out of the my soul ascending. I'm on my way. Can't stop me now. And you can do the same. Yeah. What have you done today to make you feel proud? It's never so many people. So do it today, yeah, 'cause I can see you.
Last month, we began sharing a weekly message to the community from local gay activist and community leader Cleve Jones, who broadcasts a weekly message from his home in Guerneville. Here's Cleve's message from last week.
Hi, everybody. This is Cleve, and I'm speaking with you from Guerneville, California, where I've been sheltering in place for 46 days now. It's a beautiful area, and I like doing these Sunday afternoon chats. I normally do them outside in the yard because it's quite beautiful. I'm learning that gardening is really weeding, but I did want to share, since I'm inside, a little bit from my garden. These are some of my flowers, roses and irises. And today is also a milestone in my new gardening adventure. I have harvested my first two artichokes, so I'm happy about that. I want to chat a little bit about what's going on, as I always do. Like many of you, I'm lonely, and it's very difficult to be separated from my family, from my partner, from our dog. I'm frightened. I wake up in the middle of the night sometimes feeling just a real deep sense of panic. There's sort of a low-level anxiety all the time. Like many of you, I'm taking a serious financial hit, which causes a great deal of anxiety. I'm also afraid of getting sick. And I hear these terrible stories about people dying alone in hospitals without their families and friends there. And that is, to me, very frightening. So yeah, I'm scared and I'm lonely. And I'm also angry that this is happening. And I'm particularly angry about the continuing chaos from the federal government. There's just so many examples. Where does one even begin? But I'm most concerned about the testing problem, the fact that testing is not more widely available, is not more reliable. Without testing, we can't track the disease. We can't trace contacts. We can't allocate resources properly. And we can't determine one of the most important issues, which is whether or not those of us who have been infected and had no symptoms or had symptoms and recovered, whether those folks now have immunity. That is still a question that has not been answered. And I think for all of us who, like myself, survived the HIV pandemic in the 80s and 90s, it brings back a lot of really dark memories. And I'm reminded that all these years later, 40 years later, we still don't have a cure for AIDS and we still don't have a vaccine. So when I hear people saying, oh, don't worry, you know, they'll have a vaccine in 18 months, I am not so confident. So I'm trying to prepare myself emotionally for this to be a long haul. And I do believe that someday soon we'll have a better life, but I don't think it's going to happen quickly. I also want to mention an anniversary that connects to all of this. It was 40 years ago this week that a young man named Ken Horn was reported to the Centers for Disease Control with a disease called Kaposi's sarcoma. A couple years later, he would be officially recognized by the Centers for Disease Control as the first patient in the United States to get HIV/AIDS. I would not read about him until about a year later when his case was one of many reported in the weekly report out of the Centers for Disease Control. That came out in 81. And I was working in the state legislature. I was a consultant to the Assembly Health Committee. So I was reading all of these journals and everything. And that's how I first learned about it in the summer of 1981. And you know, by the summer of 1985, almost everyone I knew was dead or dying or caring for someone who was dying. So this this current situation reminds me of a terrible time in my past. And then it's also important to remember that we moved forward despite the horror of it, despite the losses, despite the deaths. We did move forward. And many of those lessons that we learned then, we need to pay attention to now. I particularly recall some of the worst of that time when I see these folks marching and protesting and taking their cues from Donald Trump and calling this whole thing a hoax. There were people in my community who did the same thing when AIDS came. They were the denialists, and they said that it was all a conspiracy. It was a government plot to kill gay people or some other nonsense. And you know, they went so far as one of them even denied testing and treatment to her own daughter, who then died as a result. So this phenomena of people disregarding science, sadly, is not new. This phenomena of people being irresponsible and not caring about the well-being and health of others is not new. We've seen this before. We hear a lot about how we're all in this together, but you know, it's not really true, because while the whole world may be threatened, it is the most vulnerable among us who are suffering the worst. And we see it very clearly that the death rate, the infection rate are higher among communities of color. And we see that these frontline workers, healthcare workers, emergency first responders, hotel workers, food service folks, the people that ring up your groceries at the Safeway, these are frontline workers. And these are the people that have been trying so hard to be treated with a little more respect, some dignity, and a living wage. So this pandemic is exposing in a very harsh light the inequalities of our society. And if there ever is a normal again, I hope it's a new normal where all of us can live with dignity and justice. So to all of you that took the time to watch, greetings from Guerneville, California. And please stay safe, stay home, take care of each other, and I'll see you again next Sunday. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Cleve. Tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Music with Cheryl Cabanook. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on Radio 91. And in the meantime, when staying connected is so important, we invite you to download the KRCB mobile app for your Apple or Android device. The KRCB mobile app allows you to access news and your favorite radio show, like Outbeat, from anywhere in the world with internet access. The KRCB mobile app is yours to use, and it's always free. On air, online, or on the go, we are Radio 91, KRCB-FM Windsor, and K215-CQ Santa Rosa, a service of Northern California Public Media. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Afropop is next.